Where I'd like you to turn, if you would, is to John chapter 4 and verse 43. And what we're going to do today is look at one rather brief account in more detail and get, I hope, a better picture of this particular incident that was early in Jesus' ministry and get an appreciation for some of the context of what happened and also how it even has an influence on things that may have happened later. And to cap it off, perhaps we can learn some individual lessons, which I will invite your input on what our takeaways can be from this story. In John chapter 4, beginning in verse 43, I'll read. I have the King James with me today, so I'll just read from the King James. And we'll read to the end of the chapter. Now, after 2 days, he left from there, and he went into Galilee. And Jesus himself had testified that a prophet has no honor in his own country. And 45 says, and then when he came into Galilee, the Galileans received him, having seen all the things that he did in Jerusalem at the feast, for they also went to the feast. And Jesus came again to Cana of Galilee, where he made the water wine. And there was a certain nobleman whose son was sick at Capernaum. And when he heard that Jesus was come out of Judea into Galilee, he went to him and besought him that he would come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. And Jesus said unto him, well, except you see the signs and wonders, you will not believe. And the nobleman said, sir, come down before my child dies. And Jesus said to him, go your way, your son lives. And the man believed the word that Jesus had spoken to him, and he went about his way, or went his way. And as he was now going down, his servants met him and told him, saying, your son lives. Then inquired he of them the hour when he began to amend, and they said to him, yesterday at the seventh hour, the fever left him. So the father knew that it was at the same hour in which Jesus had said to him, your son lives, and himself believed, and his whole house. This is, again, the second miracle that Jesus did when he was come out of Judea into Galilee. So I want to break this down verse by verse today. If you have any input, please interrupt me if I don't ask. Raise your hand or have something to say. You may have a different translation or a study Bible that has something interesting there, so we'll let it be collaborative. But if not, I have brought plenty of information myself. We're in beginning in verse 43, and it says that after 2 days he departed from there, or thence, it says here, and went into Galilee. So the first question is, where was he? Where did he depart from? And you've got it doesn't actually say it, but back at the beginning of verse 4, it says that, we'll read chapter 4, go back to chapter 4, verse 1, it says, wherefore the Lord knew how the Pharisees heard that that Jesus made and baptized more disciples than John, although Jesus himself didn't baptize, but his disciples. He left Judea and departed again into Galilee. And in order to do that, he had to go through Samaria. So, and then he came to the city of Samaria called Sychar, which was near to the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. So, you remember, in fact, I'm going to draw here. If you look at, that's not going to be dark enough, is it? You look at Israel, you've got the Sea of Galilee up here, you've got the Dead Sea down here, you've got the Jordan that goes in between, and you've got Jerusalem that's over here, you've got Nazareth, you've got Cana, which is maybe about here, should be a little bit further south, I'm sorry, maybe Cana, Sepphoris, that Gary Stoschek had talked to us about. In between this area, this region, which is called Galilee, and down here, which is called Judea, you have Samaria. This is not to scale, trust me. Samaria is longer and skinnier than that. And we've talked about this before, that a pious Jew, if he had to travel from Galilee to the feast, as it says here, we just read that the Galileans had gone down to Jerusalem for the feast. Now, Jerusalem's actually a lot closer. Let's put that Jerusalem right here. Jerusalem's a lot closer to the Dead Sea. Jericho's on the way up. They would come down here, down the Jordan Valley, go up through Jericho to Jerusalem. That was typically how they would travel. But here it says that Jesus had decided, he was in Judea, he was going to go up to Galilee, and he decided to travel through Samaria. And that's interesting, and it teaches us something here. And he went to this city, and he had this interaction there with the woman at the well, which we won't go into. So Jesus was traveling from Judea back up to Galilee. It says after 2 days, he had spent 2 days apparently in his town, and then he was headed up to Galilee again, which is where he was from. It's where he was raised. Now, it doesn't say specifically that the trip that he was going to take was from this Sychar up to wherever he was going to Galilee, but we can assume that that's something similar. I mean, he could have left wherever the well was and gone somewhere else and then had a journey. But in any event, it would take a couple of days, most likely. From Sychar, am I saying that right? Anybody know better how to say that? From Sychar to the region of Galilee was about 40 miles, which would take about 2 to 3 days travel because they walked. Typically. And that shows also, of course, that Jesus took the direct route. And he didn't always do that, but sometimes he did. You also read stories where he would go up through Jericho, and he would go through Bethany, Jericho, and then Bethany, and then into Jerusalem. Bethany was where Lazarus lived, and Mary and Martha. So he took different ways. But he didn't have a phobia, or he wasn't worried about going through Samaria. He was teaching his disciples some lessons by doing that. And we've talked about it before that the Jews of Jesus' time, some of them, were so worried about becoming ritually impure that they wouldn't travel through Samaria, for maybe just due to prejudice or maybe due to a sincere worry about becoming ritually, ceremonially impure so that they couldn't then go to the temple. A Gentile is not an impure being. You know, the purity laws don't apply to Gentiles at all. It's irrelevant in God's eyes, I think. But the idea was, of course, that a Gentile is going to be eating these kinds of foods and doing sacrificing things to idols and all this type of thing. And then if you come in contact with that, then you've come in contact with something that's impure. It makes you impure and so on. That was the reasoning. That's not actually, best I can tell, I don't read that. I just read through the Pentateuch. Since the feast, and I don't see God saying you can't have anything to do. You know, you can't just leave the world, as Paul said. But the Pharisees, in particular, put lots of hedges around the law to make sure that the law wasn't broken. And they were extra careful, and part of those regulations had to do with separating Jews from other people. And they weren't God's rules; they were extra rules that were added on to try to maintain purity. I think in some cases, I don't want to paint this with a broad brush, and if you disagree with me, please raise your hand here, but in some cases, it could lead to a prejudice. You had a prejudice against other people. Not in all cases, because there were Pharisees out there trying, you know, evangelizing and trying to draw people into the Jewish religion, and as was it Jesus who says, well, you celebrate every time you have a convert? Well, they did have converts, and that wasn't a bad thing. How they went about it may have had its negative aspects, but the idea that the Jews of Jesus' time, at least many of them, were certainly open to and desirous of attracting Gentiles to the religion and having them become converts. But nonetheless, if they weren't converts and they weren't God-fearers, then they were in a different category, and they were treated differently, and you had this idea, well, we can't even go through the territory, we're going to go around it. And so you had these kinds of things going on, which I think, from the way I read the histories, it sounds as if what we would call in modern days a certain prejudice, or a certain, what's the other word when you have a phobia for xenophobia, a fear or a treat foreigners differently. Any comments on that? I don't want to misrepresent anything here. It's difficult when you want to say they were all this way or they're all that way. When you read the book of John, and we'll notice it a couple times as we read through here, John, for whatever reason, Hugh and I have had this discussion back and forth about what the reason is, but writing later, I think mostly because of writing later and writing after the time of the temple, John will remind his readers what the Jews used to do, because it was so long ago that the Jews used to do that. Then Jews still did certain things, but they couldn't do it in the same way because there was no temple. So, yes?
When Peter comes into Cornelius' house, he states that it's unlawful for him even to be there.
But that was, okay, go ahead. Is that?
Well, it wasn't obviously, it wasn't God's law, but Peter said it wasn't lawful for him to.
Right. Go ahead, Mike.
During that time period, there were two big major Pharisee groups, the house of Shammai and the house of Hillel. Christ actually followed, well, I think, I want to rephrase that. Hillel actually followed Christ's teaching, not in that sense that he followed him, but their teachings were similar.
Mm-hmm.
Shammai, the house of Shammai, came up with 18, I don't even know what to call them, decrees, to separate the Jews and the Gentiles. And we don't even hear about this. We don't even think of it when we look to scriptures. They were to separate, and the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai had a battle. One time, actually, the house of Shammai killed some of the house of Hillel. So it was a struggle going on during that time period between the Jews, between the Pharisees. And we don't even think about that when we look at things. And that's going on here, and I think that's part of what John's dealing with.
Just in case that doesn't make it onto the tape, I'll just briefly summarize. Hugh pointed out that Peter mentioned that it was unlawful for him to be in the house of Cornelius, and then Mike pointed out that the house of the followers of Hillel and the followers of Shammai, two influential rabbis in those times, or I think, were they already gone by then? They were already dead.
Yeah.
but their teachings were still very influential.
Those 18 decrees, they aren't recorded anymore. It's actually said, when they had the battle and people were killed, it was worse than the time when they worshipped the golden calf.
Okay.
So it was a terrible time in their history.
So the followers of Shammai were very concerned, we might call it conservative, and very concerned about ritual impurity, and they had created a whole list of laws, 18 of them, rules to try to keep people separate. And the followers of Hillel were not so bound by those things, and that Jesus' teachings tend to mirror Hillel's more than Shammai's. So we have to be careful, just to really put a summary on this. You have to be careful when you say the Jews did this or the Jews did that, because the Jews are just like saying the Americans do this or Americans do that. Well, yeah, we do some things that are pretty much kind of like what Americans do. If you live in another part of the world, you say, well, you Americans are like this. But we know, obviously, that Americans do many, many different things, and we don't all agree. And it was the same way in the Judaism of the time of Jesus. And not only that, but you had different geographical areas. You had Jews who lived up in Galilee, up in the hill country. You had Jews who lived down here, and you had Jews in the diaspora that were all over the world. And so you had all these differences. So we don't want to use too broad of a brush and say the Jews did this or Jews did that. Okay, the story here takes place in Cana. Cana, I think I talked about this before. I talked about the wine, the miracle. The first miracle that's recorded here in the book of John is that Jesus changed the water to wine. And Cana was a town that was kind of on the road from Nazareth to Capernaum. Capernaum was up here on the northwest shore of the Sea of Galilee. And this was like the hub. This is where things happened in this area. It was the Harrisburg for maybe you people up here, or the Baltimore for down where I live. It was a local place. It's where they collected the customs. It's where the main trading routes came through there. And all that happened in Capernaum. If you went, Nazareth was one of the you know, it's not a suburb. It was out in the boonies. But if you wanted to go to town, you were going to go to Capernaum, and you were going to travel through Cana, most likely. That was the road. And let's see. I want to see something else about this. Again, this is a valley. Okay? The sea, I forget how far down below sea level the Dead Sea is. It's over 1,000 feet, isn't it? Does anybody know? It's way below sea level. All right? The Sea of Galilee is 700 feet below sea level. So this area here is kind of hilly. It's above sea level. You got real hills over here between the Dead Sea and Jerusalem, but you have a hill of the country up here. And Nazareth was up in the hills. You got Mount Hermon out here next to the Mount Carmel. Mount Carmel, isn't it? That's the one that's out here near the Mediterranean. But you've got hill country, all right. But you got lowlands in here. Cana was on the road where you would travel. Oh, go ahead.
1,388 feet.
It's almost 1,400 feet below sea level. So twice as far below sea level as the Sea of Galilee, which has to mean that the whole Jordan River is below sea level. If it flows from here to here, that whole valley is below sea level. So it's an interesting feature of the earth there. Back in John 2, just to get our bearings, that's when there was this marriage in Cana. Mother of Jesus was there. Remember, the disciples were called. Everybody was called to this wedding. They must have had friends. They must have been friends, and they ran out of wine. And Jesus performed the miracle, and it was a huge miracle. I mean, it says there were two or three firkins apiece in six water pots. And I've got someone here who's bothered to calculate it. Or maybe I didn't bring that. No, I think he's got the calculation here. How many bottles of wine? I think it's something like 850 bottles of wine. And this is after the party had been going on for quite a while. They had big parties. But the thing is, hospitality is mandatory in that culture, and everybody was invited. You know, Jesus and his family and all the disciples. Why? Because they're just friends of Jesus? I don't know. Or because they lived with everybody from Capernaum? Or, I don't know. I don't know how it was, but pretty much, there were a lot of people invited. And it was a big deal. So, and that's a lot of wine. I have it here somewhere. I'm pretty sure it's 850 bottles. It's in our modern equivalent. Let's see if there's anything else I wanted to notice there. That's the first miracle that's listed here. And Jesus making the water to wine. It also says, at the beginning of miracles, verse 11, did Jesus in Cana of Galilee manifest forth his glory, and his disciples believed in him, or on him. Okay, so this first miracle resulted in some belief. And that's significant, and John points that out several times. Also, verse 12, notice it says, and after this, he went down to Capernaum. Down to Capernaum. Why do you go down to Capernaum? Because you're up here several hundred feet above sea level, and you got to go to Capernaum. You're 700 feet below sea level. You're going downhill. So to make that trip to Capernaum was probably fairly pleasant. To make the trip in the other direction, as we'll see in a minute, that wasn't. So because you had to go uphill as well. Oh, here it is. 800 750 milliliter bottles of wine. So it was a big party. And a big celebration. All right. Now, I wanted to mention a few things about Capernaum. Capernaum is right on the shore of the Sea of Galilee here. As I mentioned before, Capernaum, it was a fairly large city for being up there in the hills of Galilee. The estimates are there was about 5,000 people or so that lived there. And this particular, we go back to John 4, this particular incident involves a nobleman who happened to be there. Now, we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But first, I want to make a couple other comments. One is that there are people that break up the Book of John. I don't have an opinion on this, but they break up the Book of John into what they call cycles. And we just went back to John 2, and here we are at the end of John 4, and this is called the Cana cycle. And the idea being that when John wrote this, it wasn't so important to him. And this is just for your own. You can think about it and think about it when you read through the book of John, that it wasn't necessarily so important to him to have things in a proper chronological order, and that wasn't his purpose, although there are times when he said the next day this happened and this happened, so forth. That's understood. But that the whole structure of the book is not necessarily this happened, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened, but that the structure of the book could be this is what happened in Cana, this is what happened in Jerusalem on this trip, and that things were more organized in a different fashion. Just throw that out there, that's one of the ideas, and that these chapter 2, 3, and 4 are referred to as the Cana cycle, for obvious reasons. And they start and end in Cana, and there's also a certain chiastic structure to it that tends to lead people to think that. In verse 44, back in John 4, it says that Jesus himself testified that a prophet has no honor in his own country. It doesn't say that he said that right then and there. That's not the point. The point is that he had said that, and it was an expression. If we look at Matthew 13 and verse 57, just hold your place in John 4, of course, because we'll come back. We could look in Matthew, Mark, or Luke, but we'll do Matthew. There's a specific context for this, because you want, well, there's a question. I mean, you read it here in John 4, it says that he has no honor in his own country, but then it says the Galileans received him. So why is that? So in Matthew chapter 13, verse 57, it says, here are these people near his hometown. You know, isn't this the carpenter's son? Isn't his mother called Mary? And we know his brothers. This is verse 55. And his sisters, aren't they all with us? And, you know, who is this guy? You know, they didn't give him any credit. And they were offended in him, but Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor except for in his own country and in his own house. And in fact, there are some in the New American Standard, if anybody has that, it either here or in one of the parallel versions, it says in his own hometown. You know, you don't have honor in your own hometown. And that was certainly true. And Jesus had performed, performed that miracle in Cana, but then he had performed other miracles. And here in verse 44, it recounts that, saying, well, Jesus had said that a prophet is not without honor except in his own country. In other words, a prophet can be honored anywhere but at home. In his hometown, you don't get any respect. It's the old Rodney Dangerfield thing. And that's it. He felt that. But in verse 45, it says, when he came into Galilee, the Galileans received him, having seen all the things that he did in Jerusalem at the feast, for they also went to the feast. So here it's New Testament indication, if you didn't believe it, that the idea of pilgrimage feasts were still around, that people were expected as much as possible to leave their homes and make the pilgrimage down to Jerusalem to the temple for the festivals. And that the people in Galilee, it's only several days worth, maybe a week, whatever, of a trip, they could get down there for the festivals, and they did as often as they could. And in this case, they had been there, they had seen him, they had heard him, they'd seen things he'd done, and because of that, they were receptive when he came back. Doesn't say that they honored him, maybe he was still without honor, but at least they accepted him because they had seen his miracles and so forth in down in Judea. Let's see if there's anything else I want to say before I move on. I wrote the wrong verse down. There's a possibility. We already read it, so I'll just. When the nobleman asked Jesus to heal his son, and Jesus had that reply of like, well, you're not going to believe unless you see the miracles. And it doesn't say for sure that he's actually saying it to him or to the people around or for whose benefit he's saying that. But it could be in the context here that Jesus is making that point to not just the nobleman, or maybe not even the nobleman in particular, but to the other people around, to his fellow Galileans, whom he has already said do not respect him as a prophet. Okay, and now, so maybe he said that for their benefit, saying, well, you don't believe unless you see the miracles. Now that you saw me perform miracles down in Judea, now you'll, now we'll give you a little bit of respect. So maybe it was a kind of an offhand comment thrown in their direction. Don't know. Can't tell from the context for sure, but it seems to be a possibility. So we read in verse 45 that when he came, they at least received him. And then in verse 46 it says, and when he came to Cana of Galilee, and Galilee was a separate district up here, all right? You had Samaria, you had Galilee, you had Judea. These were administrative districts of the Roman Empire, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But it was like saying Pennsylvania or Ohio or whatever in a way. they had their boundaries, and they had their own governments in a certain sense. Yeah, so 46 or verse 46 says, he came again to Cana where he made the water wine, and there was a certain nobleman, that's the way the King James has it, or it could be translated a royal official. That's another way of putting it. Anybody have another translation in there besides nobleman? It doesn't mean that he was of royal ancestry. Yes, Mike?
A courier.
Is that an English word?
I think so.
I don't know what that one. Anyway, he was some kind of an official that was tied in with the government, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And it says, whose son was sick at Capernaum. So he's from Capernaum. Jesus is up in Cana, and he wants Jesus to come down and heal his son. Now, who is this guy? Well, we don't really know, but we do know that he's a royal official of some sort. Well, who was the royalty that was located in or around Capernaum? Who was the royalty? Anybody remember?
Herod's.
Yeah, it was one of the Herods. Specifically, this time it's Herod Antipas. Remember, you had Herod the Great, who was the one who died around 4 BC or sometime like that. And then you had his three sons, Antipas, and I don't remember all their names, Philip and Herod. I don't remember.
Alexander.
Okay, so thank you. So you had his sons. They wanted to have daddies. You know, that their father was the quintessential politician. Plus, you know, we've talked about him before, how evil he was. Well, his sons didn't want to be outdone, but they pleaded with the Augustus, who, you know, the Roman emperor. They wanted to have his domain. They all wanted to have his domain, which is a whole other story about going to a kingdom, far kingdom, in return. And so forth, that Jesus used in a parable. That was some remiss. That's to bring up something in the past, which the Herods had done. So, as it ended up, you had a Herod that was down here. That was, you said it's Alexander? Whatever. You had the Herod that was down in Judea. He was such a disaster that they finally removed him. The Jewish delegations would go to Rome and say, please, you know, do something with this guy. And they finally got rid of him, and they installed Pilate as a direct governor. So Judea was ruled directly by the Romans and the Roman armies. Remember, they had the Antonio, the fortress, right on the temple. Up in Galilee, it was a little different. You had Herod Antipas, and he was called a tetrarch. He was he acted like a king, and he probably thought he was one, but he was technically a tetrarch, which wasn't a king. But he was given a certain bit of autonomy as long as he didn't ruffle the feathers in Rome. He built a city on the west coast of the Sea of Galilee called Tiberias. I assume that after the Tiber, but that was his headquarters. And certainly, if you were, you know, that was just a place where he had his palace and so forth. The closest city to Tiberias was up here in Capernaum, so that was really, other than the fact that the White House wouldn't be there, it was kind of like the Washington, D.C., where the ambassadors were, where the commerce was, where everything was happening. It was up around Capernaum. So this particular royal official lived in Capernaum. He didn't live down there where Herod lived at the palace, but he lived in Capernaum. And his son was sick. Now, let's see, what else about Herod? Herod, just to give a little bit of background about Herod, Jesus was not known for saying too many horrible things about people, but Herod is one that he said something about. Now, this is the Herod that beheaded John the Baptist, Archelaus. Thank you. Were you raising your hand? I didn't see you. Herod Archelaus. He's the one down here. Herod. Remember, John the Baptist had said, "Herod. This Herod up here, Antipas, had married the ex-wife of his brother, Herod Philip, who had a different realm up here somewhere." And that was a no-no. John the Baptist spoke out against it, and it cost him his life. John the Baptist was kinsman with Jesus. Did this matter? Maybe it did. I don't know. I'm just throwing this out here to give you some food for thought and maybe reading between the lines a little bit. In Luke 23, and this is, you know, Jesus is on trial here. And Some of it was with Pilate, but remember what happened? If we go to chapter 23, verse 1, they led him to Pilate, and then Pilate asks him some questions, and he answers it, actually. He answers Pilate, and then he finds out he's from Galilee, and in verse 6, he says, and he said, are you a Galilean? Or he asked about him, and he found out he was, so they said, well, we've got to send him to Herod, because Herod happened to be in Jerusalem, so he was able to send him over to Herod, and Herod asked him some questions. And what you'll notice here, I should have turned some other verses first, I've got to get this in the wrong order, but here in chapter 23, it said that when he saw Jesus, verse 8, he was very glad because he had been desirous to see him for a long time, because he had heard many things of him, and he hoped to have some miracle done by him. And he questioned him with many words, and Jesus wouldn't answer him. And I've thought about that before. We kind of think, well, Jesus was the sheep being led to the slaughter and all that, and that's true, but he did answer Pilate. But he wouldn't even talk to Herod. And I don't know. You know, maybe he didn't. Is that just because? Well, maybe. Maybe because this Herod, he was a typical Herod. Let's see if I can find the other verses. He wanted to see, he wanted a magic show. That's what he wanted. It says it right there, and I can find it elsewhere. I wrote the scriptures down. Here we go. In Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9. Now, Luke, of course, writing the story later and getting it from different people. He wasn't an eyewitness, but he had heard this, and it comes up several times in his account. Luke chapter 9 and verse 7. Herod the Tetrarch heard all that was done by him, Jesus, and he was perplexed because of what was said, it was said of some that John was risen from the dead. Now, Herod had reason to believe that John wasn't around because Herod had him killed, right? So who's this Jesus guy? Well, some people thought, well, it's John the Baptist resurrected. So Herod was particularly interested. And some said, verse 8, that Elijah had appeared, and others that it was one of the old prophets risen again. And Herod said, John have I beheaded, but who is this? Of whom do I hear such things? And he desired to see him. Okay, so Herod had this fascination with Jesus for whatever reason. And all, we can just read between the lines, other than what it says here that he wanted to see a miracle. We don't really know. And in Luke 13, while we're over in the book of Luke, verse 31, some of the Pharisees said to Jesus, see, not all of the Pharisees were his enemies, get out and depart because Herod's trying to kill you. Herod wants to kill you. And he said to them, go and tell that fox, behold, I cast out devils and do cures today and tomorrow and the third day, and I shall be perfected. He called him a fox. At least that's the way we have the translation. So Jesus didn't have a very high opinion of Herod Antipas. So maybe that's why he didn't answer any of his questions. Just thought, I don't have to speak to you if the Romans were going to be the ones to kill him anyway. Also it says here, nevertheless, I must walk today and tomorrow in verse 33 and the day following, for it cannot be that a prophet perish out of Jerusalem. So, his friends were telling him, you better get out of Galilee because Herod's jurisdiction is up here. He wants to kill you. And Jesus knew that he was going to die in Jerusalem because that's where this Jerusalem that kills the prophets. And he counted himself as a prophet. So anyway, this is, you know, here we're talking about one simple little story. But if you follow all the leads in all the different directions, the story just gets bigger and bigger and to me more interesting. Not that it's not interesting to start with, but it just brings more into it. So to get back to the narrative, if I can, let's see if I've got any other comments I want to make. No. We have that this man said to Jesus in verse 47, he heard that Jesus was come out of Judea into Galilee, and he went to him and besought him that he would come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. Now this brings up some more questions, I think. First of all, he heard that Jesus had come. Of course, in a small town, even Capernaum, which was the big town, it had, the guesses are, maybe 5,000 people. So word gets around. And what's interesting, though, when you think about it, is that when Jesus came to town, he had enough notoriety that people talked about it. And this royal official, who presumably had no connection with the disciples, he doesn't say he had any connection with the disciples or Jesus' family or anything, he heard about it. He heard that this guy was up here. And his son was sick. Now, I guess I'll ask this now because it's a question that we can't answer. At least I can't answer. Maybe you've got an idea. Was this individual, this royal official, Jewish? Gentile? A Gentile God-fearer? What was he? Anybody know? Doesn't really say. Any ideas? I haven't thought about this. I just assumed, I guess, that he was a Gentile. But what it says here in verse 53, is it? After his son was healed, it says, he himself believed in his whole house. It says that he was a believer. He became a follower of Jesus. Was he a Gentile follower, believer of Jesus that early on? Maybe. One of the reasons why some people might think that is because you have the wedding, which we just read about in Cana, and you had Jews that believed, right? You had Jews that came to believe in Christ. Then after the wedding, at some point, when he had been down in Judea and he wanted to go to back home, he passed through Samaria, he met the woman at the well, and then he had all kinds of Samaritan believers. So you have Jewish believers, you have Samaritan believers, and what's the next step? So is it be Gentile believers? So it has a certain pattern to it that's appealing. I'll just read Acts, you might want to write down, Acts chapter 1 and verse 8. This is giving a little credence to the idea that he might have been a Gentile. Acts chapter 1 and verse 8, Jesus has said, you will receive power, and after that the Holy Spirit has come on you. You will be witnesses to me both in Jerusalem and in all Judea and in Samaria and to the uttermost parts of the earth. So the pattern was out from Jerusalem to Samaria and then everywhere. You know, you include the Samaritans, which were these people that kind of counted themselves as Jews, but Jews didn't count them. And then you go off to the Gentiles. Yes? Yes, because I mean, it's certainly possible because the Herods claimed to be Jewish. And maybe Jim, you know more about that. I mean, there's an argument. I don't know that the Jews considered him Jewish, but didn't Herod the Great marry, or his father married a Jewish woman? There was some kind of way they claimed to be Jewish.
Herod was supposed to be half Jewish and half Edomite, and he married a woman who was of the Hasmonean dynasty because it would enhance
his
standing politically.
Was that Beatrice or?
Miriam,
yeah. Oh, that was that. Okay. All right. Did everybody hear that? That Herod the Great was supposed to have been part that way already, but then he married somebody from the Hasmonean dynasty, which is the descendants of the Maccabees, and so that was supposed to enhance his standing in the eyes of the Jews. He was the consummate politician. He would do what he needed to do to get the support of who he needed to have the support of in order to be in charge. That was what he did, and his sons were no different. So yeah, I think yes, they would have hired a Jew, and they claimed to be Jewish themselves, but it's not clear here from the context exactly what it is. It's just food for thought there. But they became a believer, so that's why it made me wonder if it's just flat out Gentile. And if there was this Gentile believer that was hanging around the Jews, why would they have such a problem with it later? I mean, that if he was hanging around with the disciples, why would the disciples have such a problem later on? So I don't know. I don't know the answer. It's just something to think about. So he asked Jesus to come down, remember, down to Capernaum, because it was downhill a long way, probably about a day, day and a half's journey, somewhere around 22, 25 miles. I've read one source that said it's closer. I don't know. Maybe the argument is over where Cana is. I don't know. But it seems to be a trip that would take a little over a day. This, at least that's what most say, although I did read one that said you could do it in a day. Maybe with the downhill part you could, I don't know. Well, he asked this question, and then what John writes here is that Jesus said to him, except you see the signs and wonders, you won't believe. And as I mentioned before, who's he saying that to? I don't know. It seems sometimes Jesus is recorded as saying some what appear to be at first glance some rather harsh things to people that seem to be approaching him with a good attitude. As we would have read in the chapter before down in the woman at the well in Samaria. But in any event, he says it for the benefit of somebody. Perhaps it's for the benefit of people that are around. He was being talked about in town. The people around knew who he was and that he was in town. Also, I was reading from, I've read before, Doug Greenwald from Preserving Bible Times, who likes to write about the context of things. He speculates, wonders if Jesus isn't in his mind. You know, we went through some of the scriptures here that showed the relationship or lack thereof between Jesus and Herod Antipas. Also, you have to maybe put yourself in the shoes of this royal official. If Herod has just, you know, he has killed or he's going to kill, I'm not sure of the timing here, he's going to kill John the Baptist. This is his, you know, John's distant cousin here. You've got this kind of thing going on. Jesus doesn't think much at all of Herod. For this royal official to come to Jesus in a small community where everybody's going to hear about that and know about it, that took some nerve, maybe. You know, he could lose his job. He said, what are you going to this Jesus guy for? Of course, the answer to that is pretty simple, right? His son was about ready to die. And you'll do anything to save your child. So I think, you know, there's something to that there. So I don't know who Jesus was talking to here, but he said, you know, you just want to see the wonders. Certainly we already know that the people in Galilee were believers to a certain extent, only because they saw what they saw at the feast. It says that. Is it possible, too, that Jesus wanted to test the man a little bit to see where his faith was, see what he was thinking, see where he was coming from? That's possible, too. We don't know. It's just, it's worth meditating on as we read through it rather than just passing over. There's also another thing that Doug Greenwald mentions that I probably wouldn't have thought of. And let me just, I'll read it. I'll read it direct rather than paraphrase it. The word was indeed spreading in the Galilee district regarding the on-site healing and exorcism miracles that Jesus was performing. In the first century Jewish worldview, this would have likely established Jesus as yet another in a long line of miracle-working Pharisee rabbis from the Galilee. These rabbis were called the Hasidim, the righteous ones, and they were well known for their pious prayer warrior nature and for doing things for the benefit of the community, like laying on hands for healing. However, as wonderful as those traits may be, that is certainly not the same thing as the Messiah. Therefore, could it be reasonable to assume that the healing paradigm of this royal official is that this Rabbi Yeshua could only perform on-site healing miracles? In other words, it wasn't out of the ordinary in the Galilee of that time, according to this resource and others that I've seen, that there were miracle-working religious leaders around it. Sometimes, from time to time, were actually proclaimed as being the Messiah. But the miracles were always personal. I'm here. I'm laying hands on you. You're healed. Yes.
Did he mention what they were called other than what you just read? I mean,
Hasidim. He writes it two different ways, but he's got the same word.
Okay.
That Hebrew word for righteous. But it was always that the individual that was involved in the miracle was present. So is it possible, is what he's bringing up, that in this case, Jesus is going to do something different. He's going to instruct or say that this miracle has occurred and I didn't have to show up. You know, I have a power that's different from these other guys you may have seen or heard about. That's possible. I don't know. But it's interesting to think about. For some reason, Jesus said, unless you see it, you won't believe. And then he told the guy to go home, your son's healed. He just told him. He didn't let him see it. So it's different for some reason. Jesus is making a difference in this case from even the other acts, the other miracles that he had performed up to that point. So the nobleman, it says in verse 49, said to him, sir, please come down before my child dies. And Jesus said, go your way, your son lives. It was, as Hugh had spoken about before, the power of the executive word, or however you phrased it. You know, God speaks and it's done. Jesus spoke and it was done. Like creation, God speaks and it's done. Executive speech, that's what you call it. And Jesus was saying, you know, Jesus is making a point here, don't you think? Saying, this isn't, you don't have, one of your regular miracle workers around here that God works through. I will just say that your son is all right and he will be all right and you can go check it out. I'm different than anything you've heard or seen before. That's what it seems like it's saying to me. And of course, the whole purpose of the book of John that we read way back in chapter whatever it is, 20, I'll just read it. So I guess when we read the book of John, we ought to at least realize what purpose John had in writing it. I didn't write the scripture down, but so I'm not going to be able to find it. It's 20. I'm looking at 21. That's why. Thank you. But these are written, the ones that are written, the signs, that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have faith, life through his name. So the purpose of John's writing is to show that Jesus was the Son of God. And that's why we perform these miracles. And, it's different. It's qualitatively different from any other prophet or miracle worker that had ever been around. So that was his point, and that's, I think this particular incident fits right in there, where Jesus is saying, he's okay. You go home. It's been done. And what's interesting, too, is in verse 50, it says, the man believed the word that Jesus had spoken and went on his way. He believed him. As one translation has, he took him at his word. Took him at his word. Believed what Jesus said. Okay, in verse 51, and as he was now going down, it says here in King James, his servants met him. So the son had got, go ahead. Yeah.
Were the disciples with him when this was happening? Were they watching him?
It doesn't say. Did anybody have any, it doesn't specifically say, but. I would assume so, because that's the whole point of a disciple, is that you followed your master, your teacher around and observed how he did things so that you could do things in the same way.
So he was kind of kicking it up a notch, saying that you could even, when you guys come up to this level, you'll be able to do this for
them. Oh, well, maybe say, by giving them an example. That's a good point. Jesus was a rabbi. He was a teacher. He had a following. The following is called his disciples. And the things that Jesus did, he did to partly, and maybe to a great degree, to train his disciples because of what job he was going to give them. So sometimes he said things or did things that were as much as anything, or maybe even specifically, for the purpose of benefiting his disciples' understanding or his disciples' readiness to do something. And even at that, they didn't get it. And I've talked about it before. When he went across the Sea of Galilee and healed the demoniac that was over on the other side, his disciples apparently, you read it, wouldn't even get out of the boat. They didn't get it yet. And they didn't get it, that Jesus was the Messiah for all people, Gentiles, Jews alike. It was so, certain things they didn't get. It was just so much against the paradigm they had. But they, he was constantly modeling for them, and I'm sure it came back to them later. So, thank you. Everybody could hear that. The disciples were there in verse 8 of chapter 4. And typically they were with him. There are times when Jesus didn't want the disciples around, and it specifically says he went off in a boat to get away by himself. And even sometimes then it'd be a couple of his disciples there. Turned that page in his life to where his ministry began. His ministry was, to a large extent, the training of his disciples. And so it's the idea is that the disciples are going to be there. Watch what you do. Watch how you do it so that they can do things in the same way. One thing about, and just studying, when I get into the the sermon, the series I want to do, I may mention, I probably would mention this, but if I don't, I want to mention it now, is that when you talk about the religion of the Jews, you can have your, you say anything you want about it, but one thing it is that pretty much everybody agrees on. It's a religion of doing. They weren't so much into creeds and codes and lists and, you know, Mike says they got this 18-point list. That was not typical. Typically, it was how you lived. How did you react to this situation? What did you do when this happened? What did you do when this happened? How did you treat this person? So on. How did you react? What was your feeling about God and what he's doing when you had to go through this? That's very much the way the religion, the actual day-to-day religion was supposed to operate. Yes, you had your people that made your list and so forth. But a lot of times, I think they get an unfair rap because we read the Mishnah, the Talmud, which is the discussions and arguments, if you will, between the scholars of their culture back and forth about the details. Rather, that wasn't what the people were reading and how they were living. They weren't worried about those details in the same sense. I mean, they were being taught, but these are discussions among the teachers. It'd be like, I don't know, I didn't think about this in advance, but in our country, you can have a bunch of economists that they meet at the White House and they have this discussion and they're talking about all kinds of stuff that we just can't even understand what they're talking about. It's all going to go over our head, right? But in the end, the government's going to make some kind of decision that might, you know, take more money out of our wallet. That we understand. That has to do with our lives, right? So it's the same way. They have very intense scholarly discussions about things that really didn't affect the average person. And we read those intense discussions. See, these people are ridiculous, had all these rules or whatever. Well, maybe we're looking at just one small subset of what was going on and applying that to the whole culture, and that's not fair. Okay, that was a tangent. Sorry. It says that they sent, you know, some servants came up to meet him. So he's going down. He's got the easy way back, going back down to Capernaum. And mom has sent the servants back up to say, you can come home. Maybe she thinks she's going to catch him before he gets to Jesus. I don't know. Or whatever. But she's, you know, the servants are sent. And they come and tell him that his son is better. Then he inquires as to the time. And the seventh hour, which most people would figure is 1 o'clock. There are different ways of keeping time at that time, but we most assume that this means that about 1 o'clock he started getting better. And the man realized that was the same time that Jesus had made the statement to him that your son lives. So because of that, he became a believer in his whole house. So whether he's Jewish, whether he's Samaritan, well, he's not, certainly not going to be a Samaritan, whether he's Jewish or Gentile, he became a believer. And then in verse 54, we have an enigmatic statement here that I don't have an explanation for. Then this is, again, the second miracle that Jesus did when he was come out of Judea into Galilee. I don't know how you count two. There are other miracles that happen. Is it the second one? Is it referring to one we haven't seen or not referring to several of them that have been listed? I don't know. Or two of them are in particular. For whatever reason, they're more important, more particular. I don't know the answer to that. Anybody can have an answer or come up with an answer, let me know. I saw several different explanations, and none of them were very convincing. Now, in the one resource here, Doug Greenwald mentions, and he gives credit to somebody else. And if I can read it, I'll tell you who it is, because this isn't my idea, but it's interesting enough that I want to share it with you. Footnote 12. I'm indebted to Dr. Randall Smith of Christian Travel Study Programs for this insight. Okay. I don't know who he is, but let's give credit where credit is due. Something interesting here that just, again, I want you to think about. I'm following some of these tangents, but it's because to me they're interesting and it all ties together. In Luke chapter 7, if we go back to the book of Luke. All right, let's set the stage. For what I'm going to say. In John chapter 4, we have Jesus healing a royal official's son. Now, let's go back to Luke 7 and verse 1. He went into Capernaum. This is when he's up in Galilee. a certain centurion servant. And some people argue that, by the way, that the centurion servant and this story that we just read about in John are the same story. I don't think so. There's too many differences, but just share that with you. There's a centurion servant who was very dear to the centurion. He was sick and ready to die. And when he heard of Jesus, so that's a similarity there, he sent him to him the elders of the Jews, beseeching him that he would come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they besought him instantly that he was worthy for whom worthy for whom he should do this, for he loves the nation. He's built a synagogue. So he had Gentiles. Here's a centurion who built a synagogue. So he had some money. And in the time of Jesus, you had many Gentiles who were very friendly to and supportive of the Jewish culture and Jewish religion. And they would give money for building a synagogue or building a wing on a synagogue, whatever, to get their name up there, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But that was typical. That was typical. There were many Jews who were friends of, many Gentiles who were friends of the Jews in that time, not just in Judea, but all around the world. So they're saying, you know, he's worthy of healing here because he's one of our friends. He's somebody that likes us and gives money. And then, of course, the story, and we don't have to go through the whole story, but he's saying, you can just say it, and I'll believe, and it'll happen. The centurion understood the idea of delegating authority. And the bottom line was, is that his servant was healed. So we have, and just think about this for a minute, you have a royal official's son being healed. You have a centurion servant being healed. Luke chapter 8. And these are fairly early in Jesus' ministry. These aren't, you know, in the months before, right, the months directly before he died. Luke chapter 8, verse 41. Behold, there came a man named, and I never know how to say his name, Jairus. Anybody know how to say his name? And he was the ruler of the synagogue. And he fell down at Jesus' feet, besought him that he would come to his house, for he had only one daughter. She was about 12 years old, and she was dying. And then it goes in between. It was a big crowd, and Jesus was touched and so forth. But anyway, he went down and in verse 48 or verse 49, somebody came from the ruler of the synagogue's house saying, your daughter is dead. Don't trouble the master. Don't trouble the teacher. Well, Jesus resurrected that daughter. And so we have a centurion servant, we have a royal official's son, and we have the ruler of the synagogue's daughter. Now, ruler of synagogue doesn't mean like the apostle general or something. It typically, I think the word in Greek, if anybody's got Greek there, is archosynagogue. I didn't look it up. But it's the individual who is responsible for the day-to-day operations of the synagogue, and that position can change from one person to another. If it's a big enough town, he's going to be paid. But he was not necessarily the boss of everybody, but he kept things running. And it was an important position in the community. So what this individual here asked, floated the idea, can anybody see a connection between these particular three miracles? Any possible connection? Let your mind wander. I never came up with it, but. Any possible ulterior motive, that's a wrong way to put it. That's a typical word we use. A second motive, another motive, something that Jesus could have been doing these particular miracles for these particular people for a reason.
They seem to have more faith than the average person, the people involved.
Okay. That's going at it from a different direction than I was, but. This is what the guy suggested. He didn't say for sure, but he said, you know, is it possible that Jesus could have just been worldly wise enough, wise as a serpent, harmless as a dove, to get a centurion who happens to be running the base, if you want to put it that way, in Capernaum, to be personally indebted to him, to have the ruler of the synagogue personally indebted to him, and to have we've got the centurion, the ruler of the synagogue, and the royal noblemen. You got all these connections. You got people that are in positions to do you a favor. Now, I don't think that's being cynical. It's just being smart. He was healing all kinds of people. Why wouldn't you also take care of the people that can actually do you a favor? In one case, he told, I forget which one of these, he said, don't tell anybody. All right, I'm just throwing it out there. Jesus was smart. And maybe, you know, for at least a period of his ministry, he didn't want to be killed. He wanted to have freedom to do his job for a while. Yes. Yes.
That there was something significant about those particular ones that they, I mean, if, you know, 25, 50, 100 people along the way,
mm-hmm.
they picked out of those people these particular ones, there has to be a reason for that. So to make that significant in some way.
Could be. That's a good point. That is a good point, too, when you think about it. When you read the Gospels, you cannot come to any kind of conclusion unless the scripture is explicit on the matter. You can't come to a conclusion thinking that you've got all the examples of whatever it is that happened, because they're not. They're just representative examples. You know, there's a select few of the healings or a select few of the exorcisms or whatever. It's not everything. So I just throw it out there. I thought it was interesting. I don't think it's wrong. And again, maybe it's, you know, he's healing, you know, I don't know, dozens, hundreds of people. These are the ones that are mentioned. And it certainly could have had a beneficial aspect on his ministry. Yes? Well, he did not heal others. It's not that he didn't heal others, but he did heal theirs. He didn't turn them away. But I don't think that makes God a respecter of persons. Anybody? I mean, they're just one of many people, but they were people that could help him. If he just healed them and didn't heal others, I think that would be respect for persons, yes. Is that what you mean? Maybe I misread you.
Not Abraham.
Oh, okay. No, he wasn't. Okay. I thought you said that the argument could be made, oh, he's only healing the rich and famous, so he's a respect for persons. I thought maybe that was, you're throwing that out there. Okay. Any other comments before we get to the application? Let's have some takeaway. Maybe you can participate a little bit. What in this particular story can you go home with and say, here's something to think about. Here's something that I can apply. I know I just threw that out at you all of a sudden. I'll give you a minute to think about it. I'll erase it. Anybody? Yes.
My original thing is he showed a lot of faith and trust with his word.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something for us to think about. It's a good example.
These examples, and this one in particular, show a lot of trust and faith. It says specifically that the nobleman believed what Jesus said, took him at his word. And certainly that's an excellent example for us. Do we take Jesus at his word? Are we willing to believe what he said, or we want to take a little bit here, we don't want to believe it? It's something we can all ask. Yes?
Often he's really impressed with people that take him at his word. When they say, well, you don't even have to come to my house.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that was just a real breath of fresh air for somebody that's trying to teach some people some things repeatedly on the scene, hands on, and they don't seem to get it, but yet other people just kind of do a drive-by and go, I got it.
And yet the one where he said that I haven't seen such faith even in Israel.
He's
yeah.
Really
yeah.
With that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that, again, is the reason it's here is to help us to have more faith, like Darwin.
Yeah. And maybe it was, I don't know, maybe there's something about the Gentile, you hate to say this because this is a broad brush thing again, but the Gentile mind that's more willing to look at things in a simple way rather than a complicated way. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. But he was surprised by it. I got one more for you. That's a good point about the long time, too, that we read these things and we think in instantaneous terms. But in his case, he had a day and a half to get there. He had a day and a half to get back. He had a lot of time to think. Yeah.
As a parent, sometimes you're merciful with certain things, and other things make you really mad. And the things, it's kind of surprising when Christ encountered sinners, he forgave them, but what made him mad was unbelief and hardness of heart. And the only people he ever chewed out were hypocrites and unbelievers.
Good point. And believing, I just had a comment about believing. He's, you know, his one criticism here seems to be of whether it's of the nobleman or other people around, or it's like, you only believe what you see. You only believe what you see. But, you know, what did he tell Thomas? He said, you know, good that you can believe without seeing.
I don't know why, but it's impressed itself on me in the last couple of years. You know, for a long, long time we heard about the two trees and how we were going to have to make up our own body of knowledge. And it's just really impressed me that Adam and Eve were told about the dangers of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, but they relied more on their own observations about it, what they saw, and what they saw took precedence over the revelation that they received. They saw that it was good for food, so that trumped everything else.
And it's a natural God-given gift that we have, I think, that we can see and make distinctions, because that's what keeps us alive, keeps us from eating poison things or whatever. But the fact that we let it trump revelation is obviously dangerous. Yes?
My day timer has a quote from a famous person every day. And the only one that's stuck in my mind is the one by Galileo that was in my day timer several years ago. And Galileo said, everything that we know, we have received through our five senses. And that should be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't.
Yes?
I think it's interesting. What I'm taking away from this with everything that's based is Abraham, when God instructed Abraham, and he's the father of the faith, he just went. He didn't question God, I don't want to kill my son. He just went and did it. You know, just at face value, he left his whole family just to obey God. So I think these examples all show a similar faith to Abraham.
One of the things that Doug Greenwald had pointed out that struck him when reading through this was that the nobleman, the royal official, heard about Jesus. He had no way of knowing other than he heard about it. So Doug's point was, we can learn from that to maybe open our mouths sometimes. How can people hear unless somebody, you know, is sent and talks? So we've been sent. We're on a mission to make disciples, to share the gospel with people. So that's not going to happen unless we live it and sometimes just open our mouths and share with other people, because they can't respond to something unless they hear it first. Got one more. Does anybody got anything else? This one more, it doesn't specifically have to, it has to do with this one story, but many other stories. It just struck me, it hadn't struck me before, it just struck me going through this, that, and I don't have a percentage, and again, we, as Christy brings out, you don't have every story that Jesus ever did in the scripture, you only have some of them, but there seems to be a disproportionate number of miracles of healings that involve children for whatever reason. I don't know what to make of that, but Jesus obviously cared for children. And this is just one of, you know, this person's daughter, this person's son. Why? You know, it's Jesus had a heart for people, and especially for children. Anything else? Okay, I hope this opens that those few verses up a little wider, a little broader for you. And next time, hopefully, I'll have the series ready to start.